Okay, we're going to start here, 10 lines up from the bottom, on Lamed Gimel Amud Bet, Tam Rabbanan. Ketzad Avru Yisrael et HaYarden. How did Bnei Yisrael traverse the Yarden? We know that the Yarden splits similar to the Yam Suf. And Bnei Yisrael, when they crossed the Yarden, experienced something similar to that which happened in the Yam Suf, where they're able to cross through the waters, even though normally it would be impassable for them to go through these areas because of the flowing waters. So, b'chol yom Aron nosea achar shnei degalim. Generally, the Aron was found in the middle of the Am, meaning that there were two sections of the Am that went first, as described in Sefer Bamidbar, and you had two go forward, then the Levi'im with the Aron went in the middle, and then the other two degalim went afterwards. Vayom nasat chila. But today, it moved to the front of the group. Shneimar v'nei Aron brit Adon kol haaretz over lifneichem. It's taking the lead. B'chol yom v'yom Levi'im nosim et Aron. Every other day, the Levi'im were carrying the Aron. V'yom nesau Kohanim. Today, instead, the Kohanim were carrying the Aron. Shenemar. V'yake Noach kapot ragle Kohanim nosei Aron Hashem. There it mentions that when the Aron goes into the Yarden, when the feet of the Kohanim touch the waters of the Yarden, they begin to split. But the Kohanim are carrying the Aron Hashem. And Tanya, Rabbi Yossi Omer, V'shlosha mikamot nosu Kohanim et Aron. We find three instances where, instead of the Levim carrying the Aron, we find the Kohanim carrying the Aron. Kishavru et HaYarden, our case here. Ukeshe Sibu et Richo. Later on, when they go to conquer Yericho, and they do the seven times around Yericho, and they're going around with the Aron Hashem, the Kohanim are carrying the Aron Hashem. Kishavru lim komo. And when they bring it back to his place, here it's referring to the Binyan Beit HaMikdash in the time of Shlomo HaMelech, when they bring the Aron into the Kodesh HaKodeshim over there, it says that the Kohanim brought it into the Kodesh HaKodeshim. Although there is a stira between that which is written in Sefer Melachim and Sefer Divrei HaYamim, in Divrei HaYamim it says Ve'isu HaLevi'im et Aron, where it says what it says in Melachim, it says that the Kohanim carried it. So Tosafot brings two possible answers here. There are places in the Tanakh where Kohanim are referenced as Levi'im, even though it really means Kohanim, it calls them Levi'im, because the Kohanim do come from Shevet Levi. The other possibility, Tosfot says, that it was a more intricate ceremony in which the Kohanim natlu mimkomo, the Kohanim brought it from the tent in which David had kept it, then Levi'im carried it up to the Heichal, and then the Kohanim took it into the Heichal itself, into the Kodesh HaKodeshim, to place it down. So therefore, there was both Kohanim and Levim involved in the process, and that's why Divrei HaYamim and Melachim have parts of the story. Now, V'kevin shenit belu raglei Kohanim b'mayim chazru ha'mayim l'achorehem. Once the feet of the Kohanim touched the waters pull back, shenemar, kuvo nosei Aron ad ha'Yarden. So the waters that are flowing down river, all of a sudden they stopped and become a neid echad, right? That's the way that we have it in Az Yashir as well. Kamo neid nozlim. So neid is that they become a pillar or a stationary block as the waters flow down. So you have water flowing down. If you're going to split the Yam Suf, you're going to split the Yarden. If you have water that's flowing, you have to do something with the water that's flowing. You have to have an alternate route for the water to go. Otherwise, it's going to pour through, or it's going to pour out on the sides. So this is what the Gemara asks here. V'kava govan shamayim. How high did the waters go? If you're telling me it was kemono neidechad, it became like this large pillar, or this wall that stays on that side, that means that the water keeps collecting from the upriver side, and the water's piling up and piling up. The water's dammed, and it's piling up, piling up. How high did it go? Shnei masar mil. Keneged Machane Yisrael Divrei Rabbi Yehuda. Bida says 12 mil by 12 mil, which is the size of the Machane Yisrael, squared 12 mil. And if you walked the way that they encamped, then you would have an encampment that's moving through that's 12 by 12. And that would be the necessity for the water to be that high. Amar lo Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Shimon, Ledvarecha, Adam Kal, Umayim Kalim. According to your explanation, which is, call it lighter or faster moving. Is it water or humans? Aviomer Mayim Kalim. Water moves faster. It has a higher pace of movement. It's lighter than people. Imkein ba'imayim v'shotfim otam. If it only climbed up to 12 mil, and they were 12 mil going across, the waters would have overrun them at some point because there's more water collecting at a higher speed than the people traversing the Yarden. Ella, ba'meichayu mayim nig dashim, from the word gudesh, which means to pile up, volim kipin agabi kipim, and they bear waves on top of waves, yoter mishlosh miot mil, more than 300 mil. Ad sheru otam komachem mizrach umarav, until they were visible to everyone on both sides of the east and the western side of the Yarden, shenemar, because we have a pasuk that says, vehi kishmoa komachem mori asher be'ever Yarden yama, when the kings of the Amori, who were on the western side of the Yarden, heard, v'chol malchei Kenani, and all the malachim, all the kings of Canaan, asher layam, et asher ovish Hashem et mei Yarden, how Hashem dried out the riverbed of the Yarden, mipnei bnei Yisrael, for bnei Yisrael, ad ovram, so that they could cross, v'yimas lebavam, their hearts melt, v'loyeh behem od ruach mipnei bnei Yisrael, and they had no more will to stand up against bnei Yisrael. Well, how did they hear about it? How did everybody know about it? The answer is that it was visible because of the water piling up, that it was visible to everyone, and that's how everybody knew about the fact that Bnei Israel had crossed the Yarden. And so too, Rachav HaZonah said the same thing to Yoshua's spies. When he sent the spies into Yericho, and she's hiding them, she says to them, Ki shamanu et tesher hovish Hashem et mei yamsuf. I heard that Hashem had dried out the bed of the Yamsuf. Uchtiv, and it says, V'nishma, v'yimas levavenu v'lo kama od. And we heard about it, and again, our hearts have melted, and now there's no willpower or desire to stand up to Bnei Yisrael. Now the proof from Rachav HaZonah is a little problematic, because she's speaking about the Yamsuf, not about the Yarden. She says, we heard about how Hashem has hovish et mei Yamsuf. And here the Gemara is trying to prove that what happened by the Yarden, it was dried out and it piled up. So what type of proof is this that they're bringing it from Rachav HaZonah? So obviously it's not the proof that this is about the Yarden, but rather the proof on two levels. Number one is the way that the water stopped, just like by the Yamsuf, it was Kamon Neid Nozlim, and over here it's also a Neid, so that means that they stopped in the same way. Just like by the Yamsuf, they heard about it in Eretz Yisrael. They knew about it in Eretz Yisrael. Why? Probably speculating that it's the same way that the height of the water that piled up coming downriver, that would have caused a huge pileup of water, and that would have been visible to large distances. And so just like over here by the Yarden, it was visible to large numbers of people, so too by the story of Rachab, which is talking about the Yamsuf, they knew about it because a similar thing had happened, which is that the waters had piled up or backed up, and therefore creating this large pillar of water that was visible to far away. Now, what's interesting here is that, and the Gemara will come back and discuss it again, which is that you have a encampment that's 12 mil by 12 mil. In order for the encampment to cross, so the suggestion of Rabbi Yehuda is that if it's 12 mil in length, then that's the amount of time that it will take them to traverse the Yarden. And that's why the water piled up 12 mil. The width of 12 mil doesn't really matter, except for the fact that if you have a width of 12 mil, bed that would dry up has to be at least 12 mil wide to let them go through. That will present the problem in the next stage of the Gemara, which is, it seems like everybody was in the middle of the Yarden when Yoshua speaks to them. How do they fit everybody into the Yarden when the Yarden is certainly not 12 mil wide? That's a machloket how they traveled. Did they travel the way that they encamped, which was basically in the square area or diamond, really, that they encamped in? Or did they travel in a straighter line? Even a straighter line, it explains maybe how you have them going through the Yarden in terms of width, but then in length, you're going to be much longer than the 12 mil. And that's part of the question of Rabbi Lezer, Rabbi Shimon, is that even if you go in the way that they encamp, the water's moving faster and it has to go higher. But if you have a different dimension or different speeds by which they move, that has to do with the way that they were laid out. That also affects the water. And you can't just put an equivalent, 12 mil, 12 mil. That doesn't exactly work. It's not water and people are not the same thing. And how, or the length of the crossing will also matter about how they crossed. Whether they crossed encamped or not encamped, that also impact on the crossing. And therefore he gives a much higher number in terms of the height that went up. And we'll see again, the Gemara will come back to this again, and we'll see that there are more problems exactly at how they traversed the Yarden. Even here, when it says that the Yarden dried out, it says, Vayardim al yam ha-rava, yam ha-melech, tamu nichratu, va'am avru neged Yericho. So it says it dries out, the bed of the Yarden from opposite Yericho down to Yam ha-melech dries out. So the extent or the width there doesn't seem to be a width of 12 mil, which also presents a problem in terms of the ability to cross the way that is being described here as a total encampment. Alright, now the Gemara is quoting from the Tosefta, the description of them crossing the Yarden. It says, Odom beYarden, while they were still in the Yarden, Amar lehem Yoshua. Yoshua speaks to him, says, Do, Amatem ovrim et Yarden. What's the point or purpose, goal of you crossing the Yarden? Amanashu torishu et yoshvei aretz mipnechem. In order that you clear out, inherit the land from those that are dwelling there now. Shenemar, verashtem et kol yoshvei aretz mipnechem. Because Moshe had instructed Yoshua to tell the people that you're going to take out, you're going to remove those people that live there. Imatazim kain mutav. If you agree to do this, and that's what you're going to do, fine. Bimlav ba'imayim v'shotfin otichem. And if not, the waters will come and drown you, roll you over. May otichem, oti ve'etchem. So what is otichem? It's like a contraction acronym for oti ve'etchem. Meaning that we're all going to get wiped out here if you don't agree or you're not coming in on the conditions that Hashem has laid out over here. All right, so it says here in the Tzukim, Akonim nosei Aron omdim b'toch ha-yarden atom kol ha-davar asher tziva Hashem et Yoshua l'daber la'am k'chol asher tziva Moshe et Yoshua v'yamaru ha'am v'yavru. So Yoshua relays to the people that which was told to him by Moshe Rabbeinu. That's why the Tosefta here is quoting the Pasuk from Moshe Rabbeinu in Sefer Bamidbar, because Yoshua conveys what Moshe told them. And that's what did he tell them? And so the message Yoshua is giving to the people is the message that Moshe already conveyed. And he's repeating that to the people while they're inside the Yarden. And so while they're still in the Yarden, they're making this covenant or coming to this quote-unquote agreement that they're going to do what they're supposed to do. Otherwise, they may are Yarden are not going to split. Hashem is splitting the Yarden for them in order that they carry out the plan or the goal, which is to conquer the land. If that's not their intent, then the waters are not going to split for them. They're going to come down. Now, what's interesting here is that you're going to have, and we're discussing this, we had a little bit of it before, we'll have it again, which is that we're discussing here what happens to the generation that enters into the land of Israel. The generation that's entering into the land of Israel is the new generation. Some of them had seen what happened in Mitzrayim, the youngest of them that now is the oldest group here. But most of them had not experienced what had happened in Mitzrayim. They were born in the Midbar, and now they're taking over from their parents. What you have here is almost a simulation or recreation of what happened to their parents. Their parents crossed the Yam Suf and then end up at Har Sinai. Similarly, this group of individuals is going to cross the Yarden, and then they're going to end up at Har Gizim and Har Eval. Har Gizim and Har Eval is a ceremony that has a lot of the trappings that are similar to the ceremony that took place at Har Sinai, both from the perspective of the Korbanot, the concept of having a voices calling out with the laws to the people, and the people accepting upon themselves the Arur and the Baruch. Again, there's a lot of similarities between them, obviously not exactly alike, but here for this next generation who didn't experience these things firsthand, here again they're re-experiencing them so that they have, first of all, a sense of what happened back in Mitzrayim and at Har Sinai, but also to give them the will, the desire, as well as the impetus to go forward, that they are carrying out the word of Hashem and that they're going to conquer the land. So here it's interesting that you have Yoshua creating a covenant with the people inside of the Yarden and saying that if you don't do this, the waters are going to come and wash you away or wash over you. We have a similar midrashim, first of all, by the Yam Suf, but more importantly, we have a similar midrashim by Har Sinai, by Mamad Har Sinai, where Kafal Em Har Kigigit, and says, if you want to accept the Torah, fine. If not, Shamdei Tvuratchem. So this idea that there was a certain amount of pressure placed on them to understand what their goal was. Now, whether this is literal or not is not so important, but the idea being that the splitting of the Yarden has a very specific purpose. God doesn't just perform miracles to get you across the Yarden. When God performs a miracle to get you across the Yarden, that means that you have a job to do. Then you have responsibility. You've now had the merit, the privilege to have the Yarden dry out for your benefit. That means that on the other end, you're going to have responsibilities from that. And you have to understand and accept those responsibilities. Otherwise, there's no reason for the Yarden to dry out to let you cross. And that's the idea, I think, being conveyed here, is that if you don't, if this is not your intent, then there's no reason for the Yarden to split. And that's why the waters are going to drown you here, because you're not taking upon yourself the responsibility that derives from this privilege or this right to cross the Yarden in this manner. The fact that you've taken the privilege of crossing the Yarden, then you, that means that on the other end, you're going to have responsibilities from that. So the Navi over here tells us that he prepared 12 people, one from each shevet. Go in front of them into the Yarden. Each of you should take a stone out of the Yarden and bring it to the other side. We'll see. So this will be a sign. Similar, it sounds, has similar rings to Yitziat Mitzrayim and the child asking, Ma avodah zot lachem. What is all this stuff that we do here? They're going to tell them, this is what happened here. These pala rocks, which will become an indarta of sorts, a tell that they'll see, they'll ask, what is this? What is this monument for? And it's a monument to tell you that when we crossed the Yarden, the Aron went, and the Yarden dried out, the riverbed dried out. This will become a memorial to the fact that such an event took place. Siman Labanim Shavru Avot et Yarden. So this is a siman to the children that the forefathers went through the Yarden. So again, similar to Har Sinai and Yam Suf, we have certain activities or certain things that we do to remind ourselves or to commemorate that which happened, because as the Ramban says at the end of Parshat Bo, famous Ramban there says that God doesn't perform miracles in every generation. Every person who has some questions about their faith, God's not all of a sudden going to split the Yam Suf and have a Har Sinai for them. So we have certain memorials or certain practices that we take up that will be signs of the Mesorah. And that passed down from generation to generation. We'll say, there's a pile of rocks here. Why is there a pile of rocks here? Well, my father told me that when they crossed the Yarden, these are the rocks that they took out. And that father tells to their son, that son to their son, and so on and so forth. There's a Mesorah about this memorial, similar to the other practices that we do, Zecher Letziat Mitzrayim, or the Korban HaPesach, or the eating of the Matzot. All of these ideas are commemorative actions that make us relive those events through a Mesorah from generation to generation that's passed down. And similarly over here, the Siman Labanim, Shavru Avot et Yarden, Odam Yarden Amar Lahen Yoshua. So then Yoshua says, while they're still in Yarden, Sulachem Mizeh Mitoch Yarden, Mei Matzav Raglei HaKohanim, that you should take out rocks here from the place where the Kohanim are entrenched, because the Aron goes into the waters, the waters split, and the Kohanim stay in the middle to hold the waters in abeyance until everybody crosses, and then the Aron finally leaves. When the Aron leaves, the waters go back to their normal state. So the Aron stays in there all that time. So what Yoshua tells them to do is to go to where the place where the Kohanim are standing in the water and holding the Aron, there they should go and take Tavuotam Lemor Sulachem Zemi Tochayademi Matzav Ragle Kohanim Hachin Shtemisri Avanim. Should take those 12 rocks, Vavartem Otam Imachem, and then cross with them, Vinachtem Otam Balamalon Asher Telinu Bo Halayla. And then you should place them down where we're going to encamp tonight. Yechol b'chol malon malon. You think that everywhere they encamped, they put down Torah. So malon marshet alino bo'alayla. Only tonight, where we're going to encamp tonight, that's where you're going to put up this memorial or this endarta that has the 12 rocks in it. Amar Rabbi Yehuda Abba Chalafta, Rabbi Lezer ben Matya, v'chananya ben Hachinai. Amdu otam avanim. They stood on these rocks. And that they estimated that each one of these rocks was the size of 40 sa'ah, which is very large. And they put 12 of these rocks together to make this andarta, the gemirah. And then this parlays or segues into something that's not necessarily related, but takes us over to another topic, that tetruna demadle inshe the katve tilta the tune havi. The way Rashi says, if someone else loads the load onto your shoulder and you're carrying it, then you carry 1/3 when you're normally carrying, when you do it yourself. You can carry that much more when someone else helps you out, whether that's they help you out by sharing in the burden, or they help you out by putting it on, loading you up. So that means that over here, if normally a person would carry 40 sa'ah, which is their estimate of the size of these stones that were carried out by the 12 individuals from the Yardain, that means that if someone else loaded you up, you'd be able to carry about 120 sa'ah, three times the amount, because this is 1/3, it's 1/3 what you normally carry. That full amount is what you can carry when someone else loads you up and when you have to help with someone else. From here, you can figure out the cluster of grapes that was brought back by the Miraglim. Shenemar, Reisua b'molt b'shnayim. Says that they carried the molt, which is the pole, b'shnayim with two. B'mashna shenemar b'molt, and you there b'shnayim. By definition, if you're using a molt, if you're using some sort of pole to carry things, then that pole or board, whatever it is that you're using to carry, would require two people, one on each end, to carry it. So by definition, you would have shnayim. So why is it vayisu b'molt b'shnayim? So the ene yodeya shebishnayim, tamadomar b'shnayim, b'shnei motot. So what he says is it teaches us that the molt that was used here was not one molt, but rather two bars, or two rods, that they were using to carry it. So Amar Rav Yitzchak, turtani, v'turtani de turtani. That was that they had a turtani, and then they have a turtani de turtani. The way the Tosfah brings the name of the rach, perish rach de turtani belashon yavan, it's a Greek word, she kane shel mo'oznayim. It is the rod of the scale. So the way that a scale is structured is you have the center pole, and then you have a rod that goes across, which is the balance, and then you have the two scales on each side, or the two poles on each side, that you look to weigh and to keep even along that line. So what they're suggesting over here, when you have the turtani and turtani to turtani, means that you have rods that are crossing over each other. Because just like by the scale, you have a rod, an upright rod, and you have a rod that's a cross beam that goes across to use as the scale. So over here, they were using multiple motot, and those motot crossed over each other to help to hold them up. What exactly the structure of this is subject to a machloket rishonim over here. And that's what Rashi explains over here, and Tosfot gives an alternate explanation based on the Rach, which is based on the Gemara Seir HaKetzad, that Shmona Nasu Eshkol, that eight of the Miraglim carried the Eshkol, the cluster of grapes, Echad Nasa Rimon, one of the Miraglim carried the Rimon, Echad Nasa Te'ena, and one of them carried the fig. Yoshua v'Kaleb lo Nasu Klom. And Yoshua and Kaleb carried nothing. Either because it was beneath their dignity, and they were considered to be the leaders here, and it was beneath their dignity to carry them, or the other possibility is that they didn't want to be co-conspirators with the other Miraglim, and therefore they opt out of carrying fruit. That means it leaves you 10 with the fruit. Rashi says that there's no proof from here about what happened, but rather they're deducting from the scenario. If Yeshua and Kalev are out, you're left with 10 Miraglim. You hand the Rimon and the Teina to two of the Miraglim, that leaves you with 8 Miraglim. Once I have 8 Miraglim, now I have to figure out what was carrying, and based on that, they surmised that this was the structure of how they carried the cluster of grapes. And that's how they got to the 8, and that's what Rashi explains over here. Rav Yitzchak lav mikrash mi'alei. He doesn't have this from Pasuk. Ela depshitalei. It's a derivation that he has based on the numbers that are here. And ilam midrash rishon. Ilam danu delav motechad kamar kra. Oni yudim the kavein shmona bnei adam the maso. El shmina the shnei motot hayu. Right? Had he not had the first Pasuk that told us, vayisau b'mot b'shnayim, we wouldn't have known that there were actually two rods involved here. Once you have two motot involved over here, then already Rav Yitzchak comes to explain exactly how that laid out, the shnei motot, and based on that he can find 8 people carrying the cluster of grapes over here. The way that Rashi explains it is that you had two motot, which are the two rods that went parallel to each other. The normal way that you would assume that people carry, the Mishnayot describe this in terms of taking the carcasses out of the Mikdash, which is that you have a person in the back, a person in the front, say you're only using two people, on each of their shoulders is a rod that runs parallel between them. And then you can put a load in between them. Okay, that's one way. Or if you think of like a rickshaw, where they're carrying someone, or a throne when they carry someone, again, you have two parallel beams or rods that go, and then you have either one person in the back, one person in the front, or you could have four people. I mean, that you have two people in the front, two people in the back carrying those rods. So that would be the shnei motot that get us there. That's the two motot that are there. In addition to that, what Rabbi Yitzchak is mechadesh here is that it's trutani v'trutani v'trutani. Not only are there two parallel rods here, there's an additional support structure that lies under those rods. So now, there are two ways you could look at that. Rashi over here says that they are underneath balachson. They're on an angle underneath the existing parallel rods. So the two possibilities are that you have an additional two parallel rods that basically create an X like this. You have an X. You have two rods running this way and two rods running that way. And that's how you get an X, which is that the normal two are carrying. And then on that alachson, on the angle, the others are also carrying. And that gives you a lot more support to the structure. You'd have eight people carrying this. Other view of what Rashi says, alachson, means that there's an X under the parallel rods, which is that you have the two parallel rods, and then you have, cutting underneath it, a X that goes under it. So you basically have two parallel rods, and then an X that sits underneath that helps to hold up those two rods that are there. That's another way to explain it. Tosfot brings with the Shem Nerach that the motot, we're not describing the beams that go across, but rather the ends of those rods that were used for carrying, those motot are the end, like handles on the beams that allow you to put multiple people underneath them. So that is because, as the Rabbeinu Tam suggests, that how do you even know that there were beams underneath or that they carried it in this way? That comes from a little known pasuk at the end of Parshat Bamidbar, which is that all the kelim we know in the Mikdash have badim to them. They have poles. And those poles are used to carry the kelim. One of the problems is, how did they carry the menorah? The menorah does not have any badim. The mizbech is aved badim, the shulchan apanim had badim, the aron had badim. So we know how they carried all of those items. But the menorah doesn't have any badim. So how did they carry the menorah? So at the end of Parshat Bamidbar, there's a pasuk there that tells us how they carried it. And that is, v'yisubimot. They put it up on a pole. They had people carrying a pole, and two people carried the pole, and it was lifted onto the poles, whether it's similar to here or not. But that gives us already a background of the nature of the way that people carry heavy items or kelim. So if I assume a mot, we already know that these poles or these beams exist to carry the items. So then, what's the addition here of the motot, whether it's shnayim, or it's turtani, v'turtani to turtani? That is what is suggested by the Rabbeinu Chananel over here, that each amud, each beam that goes across had at its end a bar that went perpendicular to it. That bar allows one person on each side to hold up the beam that's underneath. So if I have two beams that are running, those two motot that are running, then each one of them has a perpendicular bar at the end, and that gives you eight people the ability to carry those two beams that are there. Rashi describes that the additional two motot, or bars that are going through, support the original bars, that they lend support to the original parallel beams. Rabbeinu Chananel says that the bars are used to put the people to hold up the beams, and that's the difference in their opinions. Again, that's why I described to you before, that when Rashi says that there's a angle or diagonal underneath, it's not clear whether he means like an X underneath, or he means that the two sets of parallel beams create an X, and the lower ones are holding up the upper ones, which is that Rashi says that the extra beams here give support to the original beams, and that's what the grapes sit on. According to Rabbeinu Chananel, the motot give more people the ability to raise the beams that exist. They're just two parallel beams. There's four motot, according to Rashi. According to the Rabbeinu Chananel, you have the two primary beams, and then you have the four motot, which give you the ability for eight people to get around them. And again, according to the Rabbeinu Chananel, whether it ran length or width-wise along the cluster is not clear how they carried, but that's how they carried it. So because of that, what they're basically saying is, now based on that, you can try to figure out or calculate the weight that was carried here. If you say that 40 sa'ah is the normal load that a person carries, But then with the help of someone else loading them up, you could carry 120 sa'ah. Then if you have 8 people carrying this, so you'd technically have 8 times 120, which would be 960 sa'ah. According to Rabbi Yitzchak, or according to the original opinion that there were 4 people that were carrying it from the Shnei Motot, that would equal up to 480 sa'ah. But even that is probably underestimating the amount, because not only is someone else loading you up, you have the shared burden with the other individuals. And so let's say that it was at least 960 sa'ah, the size of this cluster of grapes. So that's what they're trying to show you, is how big were these fruits that they brought back, based on the estimation of what they say an individual can carry these stones here. Pligi ba Rabbi Yami Rabbi Yitzchak Nafka, chad amar ledivrei Rabbi Yehuda, according to Rabbi Yehuda, kechanayatan avru, according to Rabbi Yehuda before, who says that it was 12 mil that they went across, that means that they traveled chanayatan, they traveled the way that they encamped. Ledivrei Rabbi Lazar ben Rabbi Shimon, according to Rabbi Lazar ben Rabbi Shimon, who argued before and says that it can't be because the water runs much faster than Avru, Zechar Zeh, Avru. They went in sequentially, they went in enough lines through there. B'chadamar ben Maru ben Mar kechaniyatam Avru. Other opinion is that everybody agrees they crossed the Yarden the way they were encamped, but Mar Sabar Adam Kal, Omar Sabar Adam Mayim Kalim. And their only argument is which moves faster, or which is more light-footed, is it the human beings or the water? So, as Tosfot points out over here, kechaniyatam avru, v'yesh lomar, arishonim, le'olam, k'shayu magim l'sfat ever, hatzad ha'sheni, l'marav, ayu chukhim l'mata b'yardein. Well, if they moved, like in their encampment, then how do you get everybody inside the Yarden? So what he suggests over here is when they reach the western bank of the Yarden, those people move downriver. V'osim makom, Ramad by Machrayim, and they make room for the people coming after them. Shari Rochav Machane Yisrael Ayesh Neimasar Mil, because the width was 12 mil. Rochav Yarden Lo Yakav Ki Im Chamishim Amah. The width of the Yarden is only 50 amot. So how are you going to fit everybody in there? Umil Hu Alpay Mama. So then he says, Ishlamar Dafka BeOrech VeRochav Chaniyatam Nichnasu BeYarden. So maybe they entered the Yarden in the way that they were encamped. V'alachash Nichnasu BeYarden Nimshchu Zeitzel Zeh. They compressed the spacing once they entered into the Yarden. Their normal encampment involves pitching tents, having space, you know, natural space that's there. So what they did was once they reached the Yarden, they entered, or they went to the Yarden in that way, but as they went into the Yarden, they closed together, and they compressed the space there. If they literally stood in the Yarden the way that they encamped, then the condition that Yeshua makes that this is, you either you do this or the waters are going to run you over, not everybody was in the Yarden at that point because the Yarden doesn't have sufficient space to hold them. Then he continues later on, and Tosfot says, V'teim al-ri, Nehi d'derech ha-reniyatam avru mikol makom alu al-ndu b'Yarden ashkemar Yeshua t'naim. Oh, the water piled up based on the size of the machaneh that's going through. But they have another event. Yeshua speaks to them while they're in the Yarden. And the water has to be dammed and hold up during that period. How come nobody's giving measure to that amount of water that's piling up? And then they had sent 12 people back to get the rocks out of the river. All these things are transpiring while the water is waiting. The 50 amot of the Yarden, it says way more than 12 mil that it would have climbed up. It didn't add up to another meal of height. It's a rounding error. That's what he says. The rest of this, or that extra time, is all a rounding error. So that's why they didn't include it in the calculation. Again, here you're seeing that Tosfot taking this very literally, which is the nature of Tosfot. With many of these agadot, he takes them more literally than you would expect, and is really trying to figure out the mathematics. So this, rather than looking at them as more parable, or as something that is a lesson that's being taught, or a Musar Haskel is trying to be taught over here, there's a message embedded in the story that literally, whether it's 12 mil or not, is not important. 12 mil has significance because that's the encampment of Bnei Israel, and therefore you can see significance, you can have interpretations that understand it, but you don't have to take it literally. Here, Tosfot's taking very literally the mathematics and trying to figure this out. Then, according to that says that Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Shimon argues and says that they went through sequentially, Then when Rabbi Elazar questions Rabbi Yehuda's position, why does he ask him about the lightness of the water, the speed of the water? Doesn't have to do with how long it took them to get through, rather than how fast they move. So he says that they argue about both of these issues, which is that he says to him, listen, number one, even if you think that the encampment they went through as an encampment, the water moves faster than the people and the water should have piled up more. Number two is, you're wrong that they went through as an encampment. They went through as a long line. If they go through a long line, it would have been even more time. And for that reason, Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon argues on both those points and says that the water climbed to much greater heights because of that. Now, in terms of the question itself, which moves faster, water or a person, it seems obvious that the water moves faster than people. So Tosfot over here says they argue about that because of the change of the nature of the water. You're right, when water is running downriver, it moves faster than a person. But when you stop the water, you dam the water, and now it starts to have to climb upwards, maybe that water moves at a slower pace than a person. And that might be their argument over here is, what's the pace of the water when it starts to have to go up instead of downriver? Right now, this also segues, and now we segued before from discussing the crossing of the Jordan into the fruits that the Meraglim brought back. And then from the fruits of the Meraglim brought back, now we parlay or segue into the Meraglim themselves and speaking about the Meraglim. So Amar Reish Lakish, Shlach Lecha Nashim. So Moshe says in Parashat Shlach, it says Shlach Lecha Nashim, which seems to be an instruction from Hashem to Moshe to send out the spies. Amar Reish Lakish, Shlach Lecha Midatcha. When God says send them Midatcha, this is your request or this is your decision, I'm not telling you to send them. I'm approving. If you want to send them, then it's fine to send them. Does a person really pick a bad lot for themselves? Hashem knows that this sending of the spies is not going to end well. So why would Hashem command the people to send the spies if he knows it's not going to end in a good result? So that's why Reish Lakish says it can't be that Hashem's commanding Moshe to send them. Rather, he's simply approving that Moshe can, if he wants to, send them. And now they're trying to reconcile that with the story of the Meraglim in the beginning of Sefer Devarim, which says, Vayita be'inaya davar. Over there it says that the people came to Moshe, v'tikuvin alai kulchem, that all of you came to me in order to seek approval for the sending of the Meraglim. And in coming to seek approval, I agreed to it. So what the Gemara, even though it's not explicit here, what the Gemara is doing is that we have a problem. We have a story in Bamidbar of Shlach. We have a story in Sefer Devarim, in the first parak in Devarim, where Moshe retells the story of the Meraglim. Moshe's retelling of the story of the Meraglim in the beginning of Devarim is very different than the story that is laid out in Shlach Lecha. So part of what Reish Lakish is doing over here is reconciling between these two disparate stories and saying that God never commanded to send the Meraglim, but rather Shlach Lecha means Midatcha. Moshe, you ask whether you can send them. I'm okay. If you want to send them, you send them. I don't need you to send them. I'm not telling you to send them. But if you want to send them, send them. And why was Moshe sending the Meraglim? Because of what's said in the beginning of Sefer Devarim, that it says that the people approached Moshe to send in the Meraglim, and this didn't come from Hashem or from Moshe's initiative. It was the initiative of the people to send in the Meraglim. And Moshe acquiesces to their request. Now, Rashi claims over here that Moshe acquiesced to their request, thinking that that would solve the problem. By just acquiescing to their request, that would quell their fears and give them a sense of security that Moshe's not trying to hide anything and would let them send the Meraglim in. He thought it would end with that. Instead, they really insist on sending the Meraglim, and it turns out that they do send the Meraglim. The other possibility of explanation, this is just explained from a broad perspective. There's a lot to say about the reconciliation or the contrast of these two stories. But one of the main things to focus on is the purpose of the mission that the Meraglim have. Moshe instructs the Meraglim to do certain things, and the people, on the other hand, have a different idea of what they want the Meraglim to find out or information that they're going to get. And therefore, maybe the stories are not necessarily disparate stories, but they both are true. Moshe has a reason to send in Meraglim, but he has a very particular purpose and mission for the Meraglim. On the other hand, the people have a mission for the Meraglim, and their mission for the Meraglim is a little different than Moshe's understanding or perspective on what the Meraglim's mission is. And that's where the problem arises, which is Moshe agrees to the people's request to send in the meraglim, but the people have one idea or one reason why they're going to send the meraglim, and Moshe has a very different reason as to what he wants the meraglim to find out and the information that he's going to get back from them. And for that reason, the reaction to the information that's brought back to Moshe and to the people is different, because the people are asking one question, and the answer they get to their question is not very pretty or not very reassuring. Whereas for Moshe, he's asking a question, they come back with the information that answers his questions that doesn't seem to be problematic. So that's maybe probably the main way to view the difference between the parasha by Shlach Lecha, the story by Shlach Lecha, versus that story by Devarim. Then it says, V'achpru lanu et aretz, you will go and uncover the land. Amar b'chir ba'ava m'raglim lo nitkavnu alo l'bushta shel eretz Yisrael. So V'achpru, he's looking as a negative verb here, which is not to go uncover the land, meaning to find out its secrets and to search for the information that was asked or requested of them. Rather, vayachperu, they're looking as a word that has negative connotations to it, which is that you're looking for negative. You're looking for the embarrassing aspects of it. That in the presence of Hashem, the moon and the sun will be embarrassed and ashamed. And that the word chafra, or that verb that's used there, means a type of shaming, or something that comes to bring negative aspects of the object. And so to over here, v'yachpur lanu et aretz, is that they're looking out to bring back the shame of the land of Eretz Yisrael. V'elu shmutam namatei Reuven, Shamua ben Zakur, Zachor, Shamua ben Zachor. These are the names of the meraglim that were sent. Am Rav Yitzchak, davazeh misoret b'yadeinu ma'avoteinu. This is a misora that we have. Meraglim ha'shem ma'aseim nikru, that their names reflected their actions. We only have one of these misorot that's still intact, which is Stor ben Michael, who is one of the meraglim from Shevet Asher. Stor shesatar ma'asav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He undermined the works of Hashem, meaning that he contradicts Hashem. Michael shesat tzmo mach. The word mach means to make oneself poor or destitute. And now they're taking the combination of Mach-Kel, that he made God destitute or poor, because he took away God's power or thunder by coming back and maligning the land of Israel. At least we can darshin at least one of these names from the Meraglim. So we already did the Matei Asher Stur ben Michael. The Rabbi Yochanan wants to explain the Matei Naphtali, Nachbi ben Vavzi. Nachbi, shechbi dvarav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He hid or subverted the words of Hashem, meaning that he lies about what's going on in Eretz Yisrael in order to convey a message of misinterpretation of what they had seen in Eretz Yisrael. Upasi, shepisei al midotav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He skipped over the ways of Hashem. Again, dileg shlo amran kashahim. He didn't speak the truth. Honestly, that is not the case. They actually speak the truth. The Meraglim tell very much the truth about what they saw. The question is a matter of perspective on what they saw. When they come back, and as the Ramban Al HaTorah points out, everything that the Meraglim say is exactly what they saw. And not only is it exactly what they saw, Moshe Rabbeinu in Sefer Devarim actually corroborates what the Meraglim had said. And so what was the failure of the Meraglim? Ramban Al HaTorah focuses on the Pasuk of Efes Ki Az, the word Efes, is really the turning point or the word that really incriminates the Meraglim, because they are giving perspective to what they saw. And that's really what's going on here. They bring full information, but their disclosure comes with a perspective. And the perspective that they lend to that disclosure is what causes the problem. And that's what maybe means over here, Nachbi and Piseya, which is that he ruins what Hashem's plan is. Hashem has a certain plan, the information that they're given is true information, but the perspective that the Meraglim give it is not the perspective of God. And in that way, they mislead the people away from God. So it says that they went up the south and they came to Hebron. Vayavo here is written in the singular form. Vayavo mi boile. It should have been they came, because you have all the Meraglim here. Amarava malameh shi piresh kalev me'atzat Meraglim. That Kalev took himself away from this sinister plan of the Meraglim. Valach v'nishtateach Al Kivri Avot. And he went and he prostrated himself over the graves of our forefathers in Marat Machpelah. Amar lehem, Abu Taid, Bakshu Alai Rachamim, please beg for mercy on me, Shenetzel Matzat Rumiraglim, so I will not be captured or swayed by this conspiracy of the Miraglim. Yeshua Kfar Bikesh Moshe Alav Rachamim. Yeshua was already endowed with the bracha of Moshe Rabbeinu, and therefore he could withstand the pressures of the Miraglim. Shenemar, Vayikra Moshe Yoshea Binun, Yoshua. Moshe changes Hoshea Binun's name to Yehoshua. And what does Yoshua mean? It is, again, an acronym, a contraction of Ka Yoshiacha Me'atzat Miraglim, that Hashem should save you from the sinister plan of the Miraglim. Again, this raises all sorts of questions. If Moshe really knew that that was the plan up front, why did he send the Miraglim when he's trying to empower Yoshua to be independent of the Miraglim? But that might be the answer. All Moshe prayed was that Yoshua have an independent mind about what he sees, not be dragged along or captured by the perspective of the other people. That doesn't mean good or bad, just means that he should be able to think and see for himself there. And that's what it's meant in Bamidbar, Vavdi Kalev, Ekev Aita Ruach Acheret Imo. And my servant Kalev, since he had a different spirit in him, and that he went a different way, then he therefore will inherit in the land and he will be saved. And actually the Pasuk in Yoshua tells us that Kalev is awarded the area of Hebron. It's actually told, the story is told twice, once in Yoshua, then again in the beginning of Shoftim. There's a story about Otniel ben Kenaz and the conquering of those areas. Kalev ben Yefuneh, in that case, is mentioned as inheriting those lands of Hebron. And so that corroborates, in a sense, the understanding of Yevoat Hebron, which was really Kalev, which is that Kalev is awarded the areas where he went. And where did he go? He went to Hebron. And since he went to Hebron, he's awarded that as his Yerusha, or he gets the Yerusha, because that's what Hashem promises him. Because it says, Ve'iten et Hebron l'Kalev, because Kalev was the one who went to Hebron. Then it says, V'sham, in Hebron, it says that there was Achiman, Sheshai, V'talmai, Lidei Anak. These were the giants that lived there. So now the Gemara dashes from the names of the giants that there must be some significance to them. Because just to tell us that the names of those people that lived there, these giants, really has no meaning to us. So then it must be coming to tell us other information. We must have to dashen something from their names. Achiman is Miyuman Shebeachav. He was the most dexterous of his brothers. As Rashi points out, the word Yamin, right, is also the same word for Miyuman. It's the same thing in Latin, from the way that the English language is formed, which is that in Latin, the word for right or right-handed is dexter, whereas the word for left-handed is sinistar, which is the modern words in English of dexterous and sinister. And that's because people who were lefties were viewed very negatively, and people who were righties were seen to be the right hand. And that's true in many ways, even the Kabbalistic thought that the right hand is the Yad of Rachamim, the left hand is the Yad of Din. And even when the Gemara speaks about a lefty, it speaks about that the lefty's right hand, which is the right hand of the lefty is his left hand. So that becomes his right hand, and his left hand becomes his right hand, meaning that they basically flip the description of right to the other side. To us that seems strange, because right and left are directionally different. So you have the right hand and you have the left hand, so you're a righty or a lefty. But in their day, the idea of right meant, like here, yamin means miyuman, the one who's dexterous, in the same way that it's used in the Latin form. And therefore, the word right, or yamin, would be used to describe your right hand or your left hand, whichever one is the stronger and more dexterous hand. And so over here also, chiman is miyuman shebiachav, sheshai, shemesim et aretz ke shchitut, that he used to make big depressions into the land as he walked. That's how big he was. He used to make depressions in the land. Rashi says here, he doesn't know exactly how they got this word to teach you shchitut, that teach you that there were depressions. He speculates that it comes from the word amudei shesh, pillars of marble, which are extremely heavy. And therefore, and pillars of marble sink or compress the land that's under them. And that's what is the derivation of this explanation of sheshai. Tamai, shemesim et aretz, tlamim, tlamim. That he makes the land into furrows and furrows. When he's walking, because he's so heavy and big, he basically makes furrows along the land. Again, from Telem, the word Talmai comes from the word Telem. Davar Acher, Another way to explain their names is Achiman bana Anat, Shishai bana Elash, Tamai bana Talbush, that they built these cities. Lidei Anak, they were the children of those giants. What does the word Anak mean? Shema'anikim achama bekomotam, that basically they block the sun with their height. As Rashi explains over here, the word Anak means like a choker, like a necklace, that they wore the sun like a necklace because they were so big and tall, as if their neck was surrounded by the ball of the sun, as if they wore the sun as a necklace and they blocked the light of the sun. Then it continues there with the description, Chevron, Shevashanim, Nivneta, says that Chevron was built 7 years prior to Tzoan Mitzrayim. So my Nivneta, what is the meaning of the word built here? Ilema Nivneta Mamash means literally that it was built. How is it possible that they were building a house for his younger son before his older son? It says over there that Ham's children are Kush, Mitzrayim is the second child. Canaan is the youngest of his children. So how is it possible that Ham, building a city, is building Hebron, which is in the area of Canaan, before he built the city in Tzoan Mitzrayim, for his older son, Mitzrayim? So it can't be telling you chronologically that it was built 7 years prior to that. But rather, it was built seven times better than Tzoan Mitzrayim. So the 7 years is not a time elapsement, meaning that there's 7 years that passed, but rather, it's a multiple, that Hebron was built on a multiple of Tzoan, seven times that of Tzoan Mitzrayim. And there's no worse dump in Israel like Hebron. How do I know that? Because they bury the dead there. They make it into a cemetery. So if they make it into a cemetery, that tells you that it's not fertile, usable land, because otherwise, why would you make it into a cemetery to waste good land like that to make it into a cemetery? You make areas into cemeteries that are not useful or productive land. So that's what it's saying here, that's way to look at this area. Now mostly that's because, and even today, if you go through these areas of Har Yehudah, they are filled with stones. There are stones, there's rocks everywhere, and the land is not easy to work or plow because of the fact that there's stones everywhere. Even to work small parcels of land, you have to clear a tremendous amount of land, backbreaking work to take out the stones in order to clear the area to plant. And even once you do that, as Rashi says here, the earth that's there is not even such great earth for planting of vegetation or crops that would be good for human consumption. Happens to be that it's good for grapes, but other than that, it's not a lot of good planting ground in those areas. And for that reason, since the ground is both hard and rocky, those are actually good conditions for creating a burial cave or catacombs, because you can dig in and they are structurally sound because the rock and the hard earth will stay in place. Versus areas where you have a much softer earth and a softer area, which are great for planting, but not great for burying the dead. For that reason, Hebron is picked as the area for burying the dead, but that also means that it's not an area which is very productive. Eretz Mitzrayim sits as the primary example of a very fertile area. We know that the Nile plain is extremely fertile plain. Shneimar kivgan Hashem k'eretz Mitzrayim. When Hashem wants to describe the area of stone, the Amora, prior to their destruction, he says that they are like Kigan Hashem, Eretz Mitzrayim. They're like the garden of Hashem, like Eretz Mitzrayim. Why are they similar to Eretz Mitzrayim? Because the Yarden pours down there, and just like the Nile River and the Nile Plain is extremely fertile, so is the Jordan Plain extremely fertile, especially prior to the destruction of stone, the Amora, before the existence of Yam HaMelech, when all that salt made it that nothing grows around that area. But prior to that point in time, it was all fresh water. If it was all fresh water, it was a gorgeous plain, and the Yam HaMelech was a fresh water sea, and therefore it was a tremendously fertile area, until Hashem HaKadosh overturned Stone Bamora, and all the salt is there. So that's what it's describing there. And so on is the best city, or the most fertile of cities within Mitzrayim, Dichtiv, Kayub, and so on, Sarav, that the royalty took up residence in Tzoan Mitzrayim, because when the emissaries from Israel go to Mitzrayim, they stay in Tzoan with the royalty of Mitzrayim. That was where the royal palace and where all the government buildings were. And obviously they were going to pick the nicest place or Tzoan. So that was like the capital city. So Tzoan, which is the capital city, and Mitzrayim, which is a great land. And nevertheless, and despite that fact, Hebron is seven times nicer, or the building of Hebron is seven times greater than Tzoan. And Hebron itself is just a rocky region, which is not even so great. So then the remainder of Eretz Yisrael, how much greater was that? Where it says, is that really true that Hebron is not such a fertile, great area of Aktiv? He says, let me go complete my promise that I made when you exiled me, or when I ran away after kimmeling of Amnon to his grandfather in Shur. Then he says, if I came back, I was going to give a korban to Hashem to thank him for bringing me back and for allowing me to return to you, David HaMelech. So he says, let me go fulfill my neder in Hebron. He went to bring the flocks, the sheep from Hebron. Because in terms of where Avshalom was, Avshalom had been in Geshur, and now he returned and he was living in Yerushalayim. As far as the Mizbeach that he would be makriv on, the Baba at that time was found in Givon. So if he's going anywhere to bring Korbanot, it's in Givon. If he is where he's living, or he's going to fill his nether, he's living in Yerushalayim. What's he doing in Hebron then? Why is he going down to Hebron? So that's what is suggested by Rav Avya, which is that he went there to find kvasim. He went to get the sheep because it was a great area for mir'et. It was a great area for grazing of sheep. That means it is a fertile area. Why are you calling it trashim? Betanya, elimi moav kvasim Hebron. If you want to know the best of things, so the Gemara in many places gives you the best place to go get olives. So that they say that Tekoa is the best place to get olives. So they have different locations where these are the primary, the best quality. So it says here, if you want to get Elim, go to Moab, Eber Yardain. You want to get Kvasim, you want to get sheep, you want to get lambs, go to Hebron. So that means that Hebron is famous for its flocks that are there. So the Gemara says, Aide de cliche, Ara Avdarayo. Because the land is not so productive and fertile, they use it for grazing lands. Shemain Kinyana, I mean, it fattens up the flocks there because they tend to do well in drier, more rocky terrains where they can graze freely and move around and eat the green that is there. Rashi says over here, because they're Tzona Shbiach Be'eretz Yivesha. They do better in drier, Trashim Yoterami Eretz Lecha. They do better there than in more moist areas. They do better in these drier areas where whatever the growth is they eat, they fatten up better in those types of areas. That's why the kvasim are found there, but that's also, again, evidence of the fact that Hebron is not a very fertile area where you can grow human production. It's good for grazing areas, but it's not good for human production. And that's why it's known as a trashim or a burial area, a rocky terrain that's used for burial. And that's what the Gemara is suggesting about the Ma'ala of Eretz Yisrael, which obviously is in contrast to what the Meraglim are going to bring back in their message about what they see in Eretz Yisrael. Here, the Torah is telling you how great Eretz Yisrael was. So on Mitzrayim, which is known as the great fertile plain, the Gan Hashem, and so on, which is the capital city, royal city of Mitzrayim, and yet Hebron is still described as being seven times better than so on Mitzrayim. And in being seven times better, that's the worst that Eretz Yisrael has to offer. So, how great is Eretz Yisrael? And again, this is all leading into the message that the Meraglim bring back, which is a very negative perspective on Eretz Yisrael. Okay, we're going to stop here on the last line on Lamed Daled Amud Bet.